Hi, I'm Ram Iyer, and I bring to you the podcast version of my article, I Watch the Kerala Story. What Sudipto Sen has pulled off is impressive. Well, one fine night we finally went to watch the film. I wanted to know what the film was going to bring to the table. What I'd heard and what I'd read about the film were the exact opposites, and that kindled my curiosity. And then one weekend when I met my cousin, she seemed in favor of the film, and that increased my curiosity. Finally, one day I gave in. Mentioning the plot in short is customary in pieces like these, so here goes. Shalini Unnikrishnan, from a Hindu Malayali family, goes to a nursing college in Kasargod against what her grandmother feels. Her mother is in support of her leaving town to study. Shalini is this teen who does playful, innocent things like making faces in front of a buffalo, poking fun at a Kathakali dancer. Very cute, happy. One morning, she gets dropped off at a college in an auto rickshaw owned by a Muslim man. The windshield kind of gives it away. The place seems like a typical college in any Muslim-dominated place. Slogans like Free Kashmir, something about Osama bin Laden, etc. on the walls. Students going around in hijabs and so on. The college, during its orientation later that day, by the way, distanced itself from the wall art. She enters the hostel room where two girls, one Nima Matthew and one Geetanjali Menon, are chatting. They take less than a second to identify Shalini, and Shalini playfully mentions the jibe that typically people from the Brahmin community hear in places like Kerala. Everyone laughs, shares a light-hearted moment, and then enters Asifa Ba. Asifa is supposed to be from a nearby Muslim-dominated town of Malappuram. She knows a lot of people in the college and tells the trio that she will ensure that they enjoy the next few years there. At the orientation session they all attend later that morning, someone clicks pictures of the trio and sends them to a Muslim religious group. The men are happy to see the girls' photos, and so begins the story. Asifa is a relentless campaigner for Islam who constantly says things that make the girls doubt the omnipotence of their respective gods. One day, the girls get molested at the mall, and Asifa tells them that if they wore the hijab, Allah would protect them from such incidents. Because of the constant peer pressure from Asifa and her cousins, the Hindu girls slowly convert to Islam. The Catholic Nima refuses to convert and confronts Asifa and raises her voice when Asifa says anything about the God and the Christ. The film shows how Muslim men pull off love jihad, lure unsuspecting naive Hindu girls, get the girls to fall in love with them, get physical with them and get them pregnant, or engage in revenge porn if that does not work, make conversion a prerequisite to marriage, saying, "Oh, how can we take home a Hindu girl? Our family will not agree." And then convert the girls, marry them, or in some cases get them married to other unknown Muslim men, and then take them to Syria. Then come the graphic descriptions and imagery of the travel to Syria, the sex slavery, the ruthless killings, absolute disregard for women, and things like that. The film is not A-rated for nothing. Now, let's get to what I really want to talk about. First, an argument for the Kerala story. My cousin, when we were chatting about random things, including this film, told me how, for lack of a better term, a witch doctor managed to make her friend's family shell out over 3 million rupees. That's 30 lakh rupees. It involves playing with people's fears, of course. The friend tried everything they could to dissuade their family from engaging in this, but that was of no use. The witch doctor apparently even dug out a dead fetus buried in their backyard. Nobody really knows how it got there. I was more shocked than disturbed by this. My cousin's argument was, if such bizarre things can happen in Kerala without anyone knowing, why is it difficult to believe that 32,000 women went missing? Next, a case against the official religious conversion numbers. Live-in is legal in our country as long as those involved are consenting adults. When you go to register your marriage, you have to show any conversions because that decides under which act your marriage is registered. But if you're not registering your marriage and yet convert, I am not aware of how one could confidently arrive at the conversion numbers that we have today. Now, I want to specifically mention that I'm not denying the conversion numbers we have, I'm just questioning them. There's a big difference between the two. In other words, if a Hindu woman marries a Muslim man after converting to Islam and goes through a proper nikah but does not legally register their marriage, they can continue to live as a couple. They're married according to Islam but not necessarily according to the Indian law. And that conversion, I feel, may not be part of the official numbers. Next, a case for the number of non-Muslim girls that get sent to Syria. Common sense would make us think that the parents would immediately file a case if their child gets converted to Islam and married to a Muslim man. But this is Kerala. Kerala respects and accepts all religions. Kerala is the state run by communists who themselves reject all notions of God and religion, but are liberal enough to let their children follow what the child wants. Since the communists have an equal stand on any religion, it does not matter to them which religion their child picks, as long as the child is happy. And everyone in Kerala is uniform in this thought. Isn't that why 100% of these people who are eligible to vote for the CPI there? And everyone wears only red shirts, drinks only tea, and eats only fish and rice. If the child gets converted to Islam and gets sent to Syria, that would be after the child cuts all ties with the parents. The parents helplessly accept it because at the end of the day, every parent wants their child to be happy, even at the cost of the parents' unhappiness. Now that the child has cut ties with the parents have no way to know where the child is. The girl could be taken to Colombo, which the parents might know, but then where she goes from there is unknown to the girl even. The girl gets brainwashed to not tell her parents that she's going to Syria, because obviously the parents would get anxious about it all. Everyone knows what happens in Syria and Iraq, right? The Muslim men, after a point, take away the girl's cell phone, saying Sharia does not allow women to have cell phones. As rightly pointed out by Shalini in the film, there was no cell phone when Sharia was written. But as the film points out, the husband's word is the wife's command in Islam and other religions. But we're talking about Islam. The girl during her indoctrination gets detached from her family. The family hearing from the girl becomes a rather rare occurrence. The child's happiness is paramount, so they leave it at that because they feel the child is happy where she is. Because that's what parents are, naive and superhuman. And this way, the girls disappear. Great. Now, a case against the numbers in the film. Now, having the points presented by the film on the one side, let's examine how the numbers hold up otherwise, because a good argument must hold water. First, conversion and migration. The film, or at least the trailer, first claimed that 32,000 girls went missing from Kerala. There was a lot of noise about how the numbers are wrong. Then came the revelation that 32,000 girls vanished over a period of 10 years, meaning on average 3,200 girls vanished in a year. Not too big a number, one might think. But even for 3,200 girls to vanish like this, there should be some substance to the number. When asked, Sudipto Sen said he derived this number from a 2010 report that Uman Chandy presented in the Kerala Assembly about the religious conversion of girls to Islam in 2010. And the report said the number was between 2,800 to 3,200. Let me repeat that. Mr. Sen claims that Mr. Chandy said that up to about 3,200 girls were converting to Islam in a year. Mr. Sen extrapolated that to 10 years and arrived at the number of 32,000. Seems fair? No. Here's why. First of all, I could not find a document, a video, or a news article that says Uman Chandy said 2,800 to 3,200 girls were converting to Islam in a year. And you probably already know this. What I did find was him saying that in the period of 2009 to 2012, 2,667 women, of whom 2,195 were Hindus, converted to Islam. That means about 889 women in Kerala converted to Islam in a year on average in that period. But again, this says converted to Islam. I found no reference to that all these young women joined the ISIS after converting. We could extend this to the 32,000 as well, no matter how baseless the number is. In other words, what the film seems to imply is that every woman who converts to Islam does so only to join the ISIS. I find no reference to this anywhere, other than the film itself, of course. Most members of the ISIS, if not all, come from one sect of Islam, the Sunni sect. In fact, the Sunni jihadist sect. Well, are all Muslims Sunnis? Are all Sunnis jihadists? Also, note that all women travel to Syria with their husbands, which doubles the number of people traveling to Syria. I'm unable to wrap my head around the idea that 64,000 men and women joined the ISIS, all from Kerala, of course, though over a period of 10 years. Oh, right, wait, Muslim men can have 4 wives, which could take the number to 40,000, not 64,000. Will these men have at least one wife who would not be taken to Syria? Well, then the number is about 43,000. Now, let's superimpose these numbers on the population. Kerala, with a population of about 35 million or 3.5 crore people, has sent 40,000 people to ISIS in a decade. While the film does not explicitly say that all these 32,000 women went from Kasargod, it does kinda seem to imply that. Because while the claim is that most of these recruitments happen from Kasargod and Mangalore, the film shows nothing of Mangalore. And also the title is The Kerala Story. That makes me think that this entire number belongs to Kerala, more specifically Kasargod. Now, I find it natural to compare the population numbers of Kasargod to the number of people sent to ISIS. Kasargod, a district with a population of about 1.41 million people, that is 14 lakh people, is shown to be the hub in Kerala for ISIS recruitment. Let us dice this down to women aged over 19 and under 35. The number of women in this age range in Kerala is about 4.3 million. The percentage of Keralite population living in Kasargod is 4%. That is, 4% of the entire population of Kerala is in Kasargod, according to the same report. 4% of 4.3 million is about 172,000. 32,000 out of 172,000 women, or even 200,000, that's 2 lakh women, converted and vanished and nobody batted an eyelid? Quite a stretch if you ask me. Also, consider what the Union Minister of State for Home, Mr. G. Kishan Reddy, himself said in 2020 in the Parliament. And I quote, "Claiming presence of significant numbers of ISIS terrorists in Kerala and Karnataka is factually not correct. The government continuously takes necessary measures to put forth India's correct position through established mechanism in unequivocal and categorical terms at various international, multilateral and bilateral fora, and also through diplomatic channels." End quote. In other words, if Kerala and Karnataka do not even have significant number of ISIS terrorists, the states that do have are supposed to contribute several tens of thousands more of ISIS terrorists than 32,000, given that 32,000 is not a significant number. By that logic, the majority of ISIS operatives globally would be Indian. How could the film or the audience miss this point? Let's now come to the passport problem. The other aspect to be understood is passport ownership. A 2017 report from the Ministry of External Affairs, which basically is responsible for passports, said that the passport ownership in India stood at 5.15%. Even if one argued that the percentage had somehow doubled in the last 6 years and stood at 10%, we are still looking at a small number of passport holders. If one stretched it, that all these people left the country on fake passports and visas, there is absolutely no way in this connected world that the numbers surpass the legitimate passport holders. That would kick off alarm bells everywhere, not just India. Superimposing this number on the young women population of Kerala, which stands at 4.3 million, the number of young Keralaite women holding passports would be around 2,21,450 or 221,450. Kasargod would be much lower at 8,858. 32,000 out of 8,858 women. Oh wait. For this math to work, the rate of passport ownership among young women in Kerala would have to be at least about 18.6%, and all of these women would have to convert to Islam and join the ISIS and travel. Granted, the passport ownership does seem to be the highest among students and among people whose income is above the poverty line. Still, what are the odds? Also, those above the poverty line are more likely to involve the concerned officials and push for inquiries. This is a wrong group to target, if you ask me. Now let us talk conversion. The conversion numbers are, in general, low for a good reason. Everyone gets indoctrinated with religious ideas at a very young age. This includes me, and this indoctrination is hard to beat. A very influential teacher of mine used to say things like what Asifa said in the film to an entire class of impressionable 10-year-olds, except our teacher was Christian. None of us converted to Christianity. During the Facebook era, she sent us messages about the greatness of the Christ and the saints. We either shut her off or respectfully declined to engage. None of us converted. No non-Muslim I know wears a hijab. None of those who have gotten sexually harassed wore a hijab to protect themselves from it. Instead, they took action. Nobody waited for God to come and protect them. Ask any of them and they'll tell you, well, God doesn't work like that. I mean, it would be silly for any of them to say, my God is useless because she or he can't protect me from molesters. In other words, most people I've seen fall in the Nima Matthew category when it comes to religion and conversions. Also, which teen or tween converts to a religion for the fear of hellfire? This is beyond laughable. Now, should the film be banned? I don't identify myself as a liberal. I stand for freedom of speech, but I also advocate reasonable restrictions to freedom of expression on public forums. Anybody who understands human psychology and the cinema market will understand this. This is a nuanced take, and controlling my temptation to explain it, generally speaking, though at the risk of sounding arbitrary, a person who is exercising their freedom of speech must exercise it responsibly, because people are impressionable. What will banning the film achieve, you might ask? People will circulate the film on the web or platforms like Telegram, and everybody who wants to watch it will, you might say. And you'd be right. Banning the film will have the same effect as banning the BBC documentary on Mr. Modi had. But ask any producer if they would be willing to pump money into a film that gets banned but circulated on the web for free. We must understand, at least after the Kashmir files and the Kerala story, that these films get made because of the money they make. These are easy wins. They have nothing to do with the communities they claim to represent. These films get made to earn well on the box office. Political parties that can gain from such films will utilize them to their advantage. The producers will be happy, the politicians will be happy, the audience will feel entertained and walk out of the theaters with their blood boiling. But the communities who need a voice will continue to be ignored. Neither the politicians nor the filmmakers will do anything about it, because what more can a filmmaker do? nor will the people hold the government accountable for these things. It is happening with the Kashmiri Pandits. It will happen with the girls that get converted and sent to Syria, not just from Kerala, but across India. That part will not change. There will be promises made about these changes, but nothing will happen on the ground. What will happen, though, is that one section of the society will alienate another for no good reason. Note that in cases like conversions, the administration alone cannot possibly do much more than creating laws and putting in place an efficient law enforcement. A lot of it is in the hands of the people. Now, let's talk about the 150 rupee lesson that I learned. When I said that Sudeep Dosen pulled off something impressive, I meant it with no sarcasm. Vivek Agnihotri showed the way and Sudeep Dosen raised, or should it be lowered, the bar. If you watch the film, which I suppose you could on OTT later this year, you will feel that people with iPhones and a rudimentary knowledge of Blender make better films than this in terms of production quality. And the story, as my brother put it the other day, was jarring. Am I denying conversions? No. Am I denying Islam extremists having terror links? No. Am I denying that members of the ISIS brainwash women into joining them and make them sex slaves? No. But that is the thing. Sudeep Dosen cooked up something with little substance and mostly baseless, hateful fluff. The little investment he made will get him disproportionately massive returns. What do I mean? First, he weaponized the trailer. He made a tall claim of 32,000 girls missing from Kerala rotting or dying in prisons or ISIS camps. He changed it later to a story of three girls, which was a brilliant stroke. The tall claim resonated in the echo chamber that subscribes to that view and those looking to enter it. The fact checkers can come later, and to satisfy them, the number can always be corrected. It was a brilliant stroke because now everyone will watch the film with the 32,000 lens. Second, when challenged, he said he had done his own research and this number could not have been gotten from government numbers because, you know, everybody is involved. In other words, he made up a conspiracy theory. That automatically took the credibility of any official statistics that we could get away. Later, apparently, he asked at the JNU, do numbers matter? Third, he touched particularly sensitive areas that people otherwise think twice about speaking in public. This led to people discussing these primarily in closed circles, in whispers. This added the bit about the conspiracy theory and ensured that it spread a lot more because we are suckers for conspiracy theories. Fourth, he did not put the government in a spot. He never mentioned anything about the government of India except implying that agencies such as the Intelligence Bureau were sleeping when 32,000 girls disappeared to ISIS camps right under their noses. He probably knew that when Kerala appears in the title, the politicians and others in Kerala, and nobody else, will react. Only those who did not miss their civics class would know that national security comes under the union list in the constitution, with the government of India having exclusive control over it, which is also why I quote the union minister of home there, the union minister of home. He perhaps also knew that the incumbent administration at the center will keep mum because the narrative favors the most powerful political party there. More so when the narrative implicitly attacks a state, which the party is looking to create its base in, and explicitly attacks communism. Fifth, blame it on the absence of teachings of Hinduism in families. In broken Malayalam and Hindi, Geetanjali tells her father that because he did not teach her anything about the Hindu values and taught her only communism, she ended up being manipulated by Asifa. This is a general belief in the insecure Hindu minds. Why not play straight into it? Sixth, the film stars no major actors, except probably Devadarshini. Even the lead actor is essentially a nobody who has not appeared in any film of consequence or ever played a consequential role. Her acting skills are to be blamed for it, but whatever. Overall, it means low expenditure on the cast. 7. The crew probably hired an intern for the CGI. The flame scenes, for example, were as though done by a novice using the generic first tutorial Blender template in 15 minutes. 8. The dialogues were absolutely irritating, like force-fitted broken Malayalam, terrible accents, unbearable grammar. Well, wait a minute, isn't Adha Sharma supposed to be from Kerala? And then there is Asifa, who speaks the Mumbai Hindi in her attempt to seem South Indian. All this riled me up even more. Low effort and probably no expenditure on professional dialogue writing. Compare this with the accent of the ISIS operative in The Family Man, and you'll know what I'm talking about. But none of the last three matter, because we are a culture who are innately imaginative. We only need to be shown the symbols. We are fully capable of imagining the rest. The CGI does not have to be good, the dialogues don't have to mean anything, the actor's acting skills do not matter, and Sen knew it. And there, that's your formula to create a multi-billion rupee box office hit on a shoestring budget. The lesson I learnt paying 150 bucks for the ticket. But hey, strange things happen in Kerala, right? First, let us address a couple of arguments in favor of the film. Like I said, my sister mentioned the bizarre finding of a dead fetus buried in her friend's backyard, saying all sorts of crazy things happen in Kerala. Have you ever heard of something like this? Well, I've not, of course. But can we equate this with national security? Can we say with absolute conviction that tens of thousands of girls go missing in a state and none of the parents or friends even so much as file a habeas corpus petition? Not even one? Or are tens of thousands of families being silenced? Doesn't that just make it much worse for the perpetrators of this crime? Keeping tens of thousands of families silent over such a big national security issue is impossible to pull off for a decade. Even if we go by the logic shown in the film, if Geetanjali can contact Shalini's mother and break the news about everything that happened to them, even if to die later, and if Nima can approach a police officer and lash out at the police in action, then compound the effect by thousands when tens of thousands of girls who either survived or so much as caught a whiff of what was going on had spoke up. The issue would have blown in the face of the conspirators. Not all 32,000 mothers would stop contacting their children. Not all 32,000 disappearances will miss the radar. Not all conversions can be brushed under the rug. And it would be impossible to ignore the connection when thousands of reports come out. And finally, let us talk about how to handle the conversion issue, because that seems to be taking the center stage. Scientific temper, that's the answer. Not mere education in science, but promoting scientific thought. Converting naive believers may be possible, but converting someone with a scientific temper is several times more difficult. Of course, someone with a scientific temper will also question your religion, much like everybody else's, but that's what we need today. Teach your children the difference between God, religion, and culture. Culture, to me, is a lot more approachable and quicker evolving than religions, and therefore more relevant, even though they are rife with issues like obscurantism. Religion and God do not have to do anything with with each other. God, if you believe, existed long before religions and will exist long after religions die a slow death. Modern laws can replace religions because, though often flawed, they are more useful than any religion. Philosophies can remain to be studied. I am sure that the philosophy behind every religion has something to teach us, as long as we approach them in the right sense. I don't support any conversions, or rather the only conversion that I'm willing to support is rejection of all religions. Discovery of the God should be a personal journey, and nobody should have anything to say about someone's self-discovery, but again, that's just my personal view. If you care so much about your religion, do something that gets your child interested in it. The more obsolete religious restrictions that you show, the more they will be disenchanted. Make them realize that gods don't have to be the silly, self-absorbed, insecure jerks that they often are made out to be. Gods need not be heroes either. Teach them about the incarnations from the standpoint of a practical life and values. Of course, for that you will have to learn about them yourself first, but hey. Don't make up magic. Kids do not buy that anymore. If you're a Hindu, find out why we have so many gods, what they stand for, or why are they considered gods in the first place. Tell the children about the different schools of thought we have in Hinduism. Today's children are inquisitive. They want answers. Find out the answers for them, or at least help them look. And remember, because that is how it is not an answer. Let your children pick their own paths. Tell them enough so that they are empowered to pick one or many on their own. Teach them how to tell silly and deep apart. If your child tells you that gods are not real, ask her how she came to that conclusion. Get her to think. That is the important part. And most importantly, remember that fundamentalism is not the answer to fundamentalism. Do not listen to fundamentalists of any religion. Train your children to spot these red flags, and that these red flags apply to all religion. Also, tell them to stay away from any of these bring back the glory of the past campaigns, and that humanity should always look forward, because that is how time moves.